Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I'm John Adirola. Big old show today. Not only am I going to be joined by one of my favorite guests, progressive activist Jordan Yule, is going to be joining us to break down the news of the day. But we've got the return of Meanwhile In, taking a look at news from around the world, including how international tests of social media platforms might affect you, your life, and your level of stress in the near future. And what does it mean when a glacier dies? We're going to be talking about that at the close of the show. Along the way, like, what was the actual cost of Republican governors refusing to expand Medicaid? We're going to be talking about minimum wage. We're going to talk about the wall. And also, tomorrow is the big Robert Mueller testimony. As I said on yesterday's show, I'm not actually going to be in studio for tomorrow's The Damage Report. Unfortunately, I'm going to be covering the Mueller report live on KTLA. So if you're in the LA area, you should definitely take a look at that. But we are going to have JR and Brooke, who are going to be in studio, talking about the Mueller report as well as the other news of the day. So lots to get to there, but I want to start off with an update on yesterday's story involving a cop, a threat, and AOC. Good news, I guess. Yesterday we reported on how a police officer had threatened on Facebook, saying that AOC needed a round, like a bullet. And we at the time, Brooke and I, we didn't expect that there would be much that would come about as a result of it. But it turns out that in this one case, the police department was actually fairly quick to act. Charles Raspoli, who had been with the Gretna City Police Department since 2005, posted, "This vile idiot needs a round, and I don't mean the kind she used to serve." He was fired. Another officer with the department who liked the post was also fired. So that's unexpected. That was not only fast, but they actually took it seriously. And the weird thing is, while that's great and it certainly makes me feel better, it's sort of weird when there is justice, because like those two guys were fired. And I think about the cops that haven't lost their job, like the guy who got fired for liking the post, but not the guy who choked out Eric Garner on the streets in New York. So that's a little bit weird. I mean, I guess progress is progress. And we should also bear in mind that both of those officers would probably be hired down the street in the next department or whatever within a month or so. But it looks like they took it seriously, so that's good. Let's not threaten congresswomen with death if we don't agree with them politically. And especially if you happen to be one of the select few members of our population that we grant an enormous amount of power to, literally the ability to choose who lives and who dies, to think that your role in society is then to make threats against your political opponents. Certainly that's not something that we support here, and it's good to see some progress in that area. But I want to go a little bit broader on this, because while this guy made a threat and faced the consequences for that, and might well have never intended to actually take a shot at Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, we do know that there's a lot of people, especially on the right, who have in the past acted on their fairly extremist views, being willing to engage in acts of violence against those they oppose. And many times we've linked the acts that they've taken with things that Donald Trump has said. And we've talked about this quite a bit, but I want to really drill down into what we are talking about with an actual definition of the phenomenon in just a little bit. But we have to understand the context too. So Donald Trump is there with his rhetoric, but who is he talking to? What sort of country, what sort of population is he appealing to? And we know that especially in recent years, there has been a growth in extremism on the right, in particular in white nationalists, white supremacists, and hard right extremist groups. And so, don't listen to me. I'm not an expert or whatever, but there are some experts who are concerned about this. One is John Cohen, counterterrorism coordinator for the Department of Homeland Security, who said law enforcement officials have been extraordinarily concerned that, based on the polarization and hostile nature of our political discourse, we would see an increase in people carrying out acts of violence. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, that is exactly what we have seen over the past few years. Now, technically, you can find examples of this that sort of span the ideological spectrum, but we also know where it's clustered. And similarly, Nick Rasmussen, former head of US's National Counterterrorism Center, said, "Homegrown violent extremists clearly represent the most immediate and most ubiquitous threat to us here inside the United States on a daily basis." Now, there are a variety of different sorts of violent extremists who could become radicalized here in the US. But if you've paid even lazy attention to the news over the past few years, you know the sort of people that are being radicalized and how they're being radicalized. I mean, how many people do we need? White teenagers who believe it's their job to either exact revenge on the women who've spurned them or to go into a black church and start shooting up the place to try to start a race war. And then we go and look at their manifestos and we see exactly the sorts of personalities that they were following on social media, on YouTube and things like that, the websites that they were frequenting, the political figures that they admired, and we can see the path to radicalization. Some news outlets have been doing a pretty good job over the past few years of detailing that path. Others have sort of bucked it, saying it's not on us to actually identify what is right there in front of us. But here's the thing, when you have all of these people who are ripe for radicalization, and you have politicians that are amoral and irresponsible and dangerous enough that they are willing to play on those feelings, knowing the likely outcome, you have a very dangerous cocktail there. And there is actually a term for it. So back in 2011, an anonymous writer coined the term stochastic terrorism to refer to the use of mass communication to incite random actors to carry out violent or terrorist acts that are statistically predictable, but individually unpredictable. Or in other words, remote control terror by lone wolf. Stochastic here means having a random probability distribution or pattern that may be analyzed statistically, but are hard to predict precisely. So it is sort of controlled chaos in a way. Now, this is not necessarily a new phenomenon. It's been popular for literally decades for leaders of terrorist organizations to put out missives to say, here is what I want to see done. Now, in many cases, they have their own terrorists that they can hypothetically dispatch on missions. But what they hope is that they won't have to do that. That if they give this appeal and say, here is the big villain, here is what needs to be done to them, that people who are sympathetic to their cause, someone somewhere will act on it. Or perhaps many someones. That's sort of what we're talking about here. It's not specifically directed. So when Osama bin Laden puts out a video and someone drives a van through a crowd, he didn't email that person. He didn't say, you do this here at this time. And yet we understand that in the wake of those sorts of messages, an increase in violence and terror is likely to happen. Now, we feel a lot more comfortable as a society identifying people like Osama bin Laden or the leaders of ISIS and other groups doing that. But what if American politicians understood that there's a lot of really angry, irrational, easily manipulated people in our population, that if you just tell them, here are your enemies, here's a party who wants to destroy you and your way of life, here are the ways that they're attacking you, here are the ways that you've been victimized. And oh, what do you know? A lieutenant in the Coast Guard is stockpiling weapons, wants to start a race war. Oh, what do you know? A guy starts mailing pipe bombs to all of the very particular list of my political opponents. That is stochastic terrorism. It is able to be predicted, although we can't necessarily know exactly who is going to act on this sorts of message. And so when he goes to one of his rallies and he chants, send him home, we know what is likely to come from that. But the most dangerous part of it is we don't know where and we don't know when. We don't know who the target is going to be. We don't know if in the case of Charles Rispoli, they actually mean it or they're just telling an extremely violent, dangerous joke. We don't know if they're gonna act on it. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in. And this is not, again, I wanna really drive this home. This is not some sort of hypothetical. We have already been through this multiple times. Take a look at a recent headline I noticed this week. Lawyers for Trump superfan Cesar Sayoc say Trump's rhetoric inspired terrorist plot on Democrats. So this isn't just me looking at what he did and said, you know what? It looks like he was radicalized by the president. It looks like the fact that he was going after Maxine Waters and the heads of the DNC and Richard Blumenthal, these very specific people that aren't necessarily able to be grouped together in any sort of coherent, rational way based on what's on the news, except that they are talked about as a group by Donald Trump. I sort of noticed that something there. That's what his lawyers are saying. And I wanna give you just a little bit more details. Sayoc, his attorneys wrote in a sentencing memo filed in federal court in New York on Monday, said that he was a Trump super fan and began to consider Democrats as not just dangerous in theory, but imminently and seriously dangerous to his personal safety. President Trump did nothing to dissuade this message, they wrote. Their filing cites Trump's Twitter attacks on the figures Sayoc targeted. So that was our prediction based on what we saw, and it turns out that was what was driving him. Now I know many of you will say, well, John, that's not fair. That guy's crazy. And I will say, yes, that's exactly the point. there are a lot of crazy people out there. And the people who are going on the stage and saying incredibly dangerous, inflammatory things, they know that those crazies are out there. They know that you had Elliot Rogers. They know that you had Cesar Sayoc. They know about the Coast Guard lieutenant. They know about all these. And has that stopped them? Should it have stopped them? Yes, yes. It certainly should have, but it didn't. And so we, as reasonable people, can look at this and say they are at the very least willing to harness this sort of hatred and propensity towards violence for their own political ends. And they're willing to accept a few cracked eggs if that's what it takes to make their political omelet. That's what they're doing. When he goes in front of a crowd and says Second Amendment people might have to do something to stop Hillary Clinton from picking liberal judges. Okay, we know what he's saying there. When he's telling his fans to attack protesters at his rallies, we understand that. And we understand when there is a white nationalist or white supremacist attack, when he continually both sides is us and whataboutses us, we know that he is providing cover for them, cover from the highest levels of our government. What is all of this designed to achieve? I think you already know, and I think that you've already seen it. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, progressive activist Jordan Yule is gonna be joining us to break down a few of the big stories of the day after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
$15, that's not enough, Brian, for some people.
What do you mean?
Some want $20 an hour. Have you heard about this story?
I have.
So there you have Fox and Friends, who thinks that the conversation happening right now about raising the minimum wage is not only a joke, but so funny that they had to have their little skit there live on air. Very enjoyable. We have got some more video we're gonna play for you in just a minute of them attacking the very concept that workers have any sort of dignity or deserve to be paid for the work they do. But joining us now to break down this and other topics, progressive activist Jordan Yule, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you here. So I saw you actually tweeting about this minimum wage story with Fox and Friends making a big deal out of the recent vote that happened in the House. They really do think they've got a winner here, that it is like so laughable on its face that you'd want to raise the minimum wage for these people that will play and that will help them. Are they onto something? Are you afraid that they might be right?
No. When you think about how most people in America can't afford a $500 to $700 emergency, that a large, not insubstantial portion of America are living paycheck to paycheck, how a substantial percentage of America are piecing jobs together just to make ends meet, you have to consider how this is going to be received in those communities when you have multimillionaires, people who rake in at least like hundreds of thousands of dollars every year to, you know, spout political opinions, to work at Fox, mm-hmm. to work in right-wing campaigns and in this political apparatus, to then say, oh no, actually, it's actually good for you if wages are kept down. It's actually better for you if we don't have a minimum wage, if we can keep pushing that wage floor down. And then you think about the cost of living in so many cities, and you think about how people need to piece together multiple jobs in a not insubstantial part of America to just afford a basic apartment. There's groups that have been tracking this. You could see places like where TYT is based in California. You need to make at least $20 to $25 an hour just to afford a two-bedroom apartment. So you think about single moms, how that might affect them, and then you see how callous they are and how they're laughing this off as this is some political ploy. It undermines, it erases the real lived experiences and suffering of millions of Americans.
Well, you're worried about nothing, okay? Because they know all about the lived experience of these people. Did you know that you just have to work at McDonald's and you'll be fine because of the charity of good people? So we've got a couple of videos. I wanna play this next one. It's gonna sum up what two of the people on Fox and Friends think about the nature of tips right now, as you'll see.
Many of you, I've had probably about 5 to 7 tip jobs. I started as a busboy. I used to do a bus, clear the tables, and we used to rotate washing the dishes. And at the end of the day, you pool your tips. It's one of the best jobs you can have when you're breaking in. You don't even expect that check. It's almost a surprise when you get a $60 or $70 check at the end of the week because you work hard, you get great tips, and if you're good, guess what? Other restaurants want you. They will take you off of your better jobs. And if your one job doesn't pay enough, guess what you do? You get another job.
We were all in high school. We were in college when we had these waiting tables. Yeah. Unless you're at a very fine restaurant, most of those people at the fine restaurants, that is their career. Right. But they make tons of money. If you're working at a McDonald's or a small little restaurant where you're making tips, you're right. If you're nice to the people, you make a lot of money.
Absolutely.
So what do you
other restaurants can hear about
correct,
you when they want you?
Correct.
So two quick points there. One, I was a busboy. That was my first job. I must not have been a good one though, because no scouts came into the kitchen looking to hire me on to a fine dining establishment. And two, she apparently has never been to a McDonald's because I don't think that they make much, if anything, in tips.
Right. So yeah, McDonald's, you don't, everyone knows you don't tip at McDonald's. I don't know why this was. I don't know. This is just another instance of just being just generally confused about what happens on Fox. But no, you don't tip on at McDonald's. But McDonald's is also one of the largest employers in the country. So to apply this small boutique experience at these fine dining restaurants, which says more about their way of living than yours mm-hmm. or mine, to apply this to a national data set is just incoherent. Because McDonald's, Walmart, and the military are some of the biggest employers, and Amazon are the biggest employers in the country. And you don't tip at McDonald's, you don't tip at Walmart, and these are the institutions that are trying to keep wages down to help their bottom line. Yeah. This is nothing about like opportunity or economic advancement. It has nothing to do with helping these people get ahead. It's about protecting profits. And they don't want to say the quiet part loud, and they're doing a decent job of towing that corporate PR line. But this has nothing to do with advancing the livelihood of anybody working at these institutions.
You know, so you said right there that they don't want to say the quiet part loud, but occasionally one of them will say it quite loud. And so I want to turn now to Jenna Ellis Rivers, Trump 2020 campaign advisory board member. Let's find out what she thinks the minimum wage should actually be.
If you look at that system, I mean, and you look at what is going on in America, you look at our capitalist system, the minimum wage should be zero.
I mean, that's like, she didn't say that she wants there to be slavery, but it sort of follows naturally from what she said there.
I mean, at this point, John, I'm waiting for next week when they say we should have children back in factories, mm-hmm. Child labor again, like just erase all the progress we've made on labor rights in America. Sure, they've sought to dismantle unions. They want to keep wages down. They don't care about the working class. Mm-hmm. This is just an elitist, classist mindset. But it also shows in Fox's role how they've pivoted away from being this media entity, and how you look at things from a journalistic perspective as the fourth estate, and how they're actually just running PR for corporations. Yeah. They're nothing more than just a corporate front.
Yeah, and I would say my one warning in this is the Republicans are screaming from the rooftops that they despise, they have no respect whatsoever for this wide swath of the American people. But that's not going to help the Democrats if they're not clearly better. If their stance is sort of unenthused, sort of apathy towards this group, and they're constantly talking about the middle class, ignoring the working and poor class. Like if they do not provide a stark contrast, then the Republicans are gonna continue to get away with spitting in the face of millions of Americans. And that really is my fear.
Absolutely. You can't have this tepid piecemeal approach in response to this extreme overreaching mindset from the right. You need to be bold, you need to be progressive, and you need to just show your values.
Yeah. So I want to transition now to another topic, and this has to do with some criticism towards Donald Trump from what's ostensibly a conservative outlet. Donald Trump wants to get elected, and he knows that there's a couple of the big promises he made that's going to need that he's going to need to get reelected. One is building a wall. With a capital W. But according to the Washington Examiner this week, in a statement last week, US Customs and Border Protection, the federal agency overseeing border barrier construction, confirmed that all of the fencing completed since Trump took office is, quote, in place of dilapidated designs because the existing fence was in need of replacement. And they say that not a single mile of new unplanned wall has actually been made, which I'm going to keep it real. I found that to be shocking. Were you surprised to find out that they had only done planned wall and replacement?
Yeah, a little bit. I was surprised because Trump's building the wall. I'm building the wall. We've got many, many miles of beautiful wall. All of these talking points have been staples of his rallies, his tweets, his media appearances. I mean, for the casual observer, you would think that there's hundreds, if not thousands, of miles of wall already built. So it was pretty funny. But the reaction, he can't handle that anyone has broken from this right-wing party line. You have the Washington Examiner, like you said, is ostensibly a right-leaning outlet, mostly flattering coverage of Trump, his administration, and their doings. To have them, of all people, report out that it's actually no new wall, it's just replacements. That's in his reaction, and then amplified by Drudge, another sympathetic media figure. Just shows how he can't handle anyone breaking from this right-wing ecosystem. He's so used to Fox just parroting his claims, defending his every move, that when anyone breaks, he can't handle it. His mind just freaks out.
Yeah. And to anyone watching, let's not celebrate. He's 2 years into his presidency. There's a lot of time for him to still do that, especially considering the money that was given to him earlier this year. I do want to read his brief response, though, because he did freak out when he saw this. When an old wall capitalized at the southern border, all capitalized, that is crumbling and falling over, built in an important section to keep out problems, is replaced with a brand new 30-foot high steel and concrete wall. The capital M Media says no new wall has been built. Fake news, building lots of wall. I think we should just get building lots of wall carved into our nation's tombstone. Because that is really a sentence there.
Yeah, so when I heard we were talking about this today, I went back and looked at some of his old tweets and just searched for words like building the wall, miles of wall, all these different things. And it goes back, he's claiming that it's being built, it's beautiful, everyone's got to see it. He's posted videos of it, and now we see the reality. And again, this shows the relationship that media outlets have with the Trump administration that no one is really willing to report out on this. But also, I do think it highlights the revolving door between outlets like Fox and other right-wing outlets and the Trump administration. And how's there, Raj Shah, for instance, you might remember him, he worked in the communications department at the White House, very quietly recently just joined Fox News as an executive. So we need to be mindful of this and how these people are just going to and from and ultimately working this phony narrative together. Like hand in hand, Fox and right-wing outlets and the Trump administration are pushing this complete phony narrative onto us.
Yeah, with that revolving door, it almost feels like it's a step beyond just state media, because state media is deferential, but it isn't, I don't think, historically actually composed of people formerly as a part of the regime. But we'll keep an eye on that. Jordan, we're gonna take a short break, but if you can stick around, I wanna touch base with some of the expectations we have for tomorrow's Robert Mueller testimony on the other side of this break. Tomorrow, at long last, Robert Mueller, the head of the special investigation into Donald Trump and the 2016 campaign, will finally go before Congress and speak. He's going to be questioned. And I know that a lot of people have very high hopes for what might come of that. But I really do have my suspicions about how little it might change the status quo conversation around some of these issues. But we're going to hash it out. And joining me now to talk about this, Jordan Ewell, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Sean.
So let's say tomorrow we're finally going to have Robert Mueller. What do you expect to happen coming out of this? Do you think that we will have learned anything new?
No, I don't think so. Mueller has been pretty clear in his comments to the media that he doesn't plan on saying anything that wasn't in the public report. We've seen the Department of Justice instruct him not to veer from the public report. I think it's just going to be a highly sensationalized just regurgitation of what we already know.
Well, so in terms of it being sensationalized, I remember the Kavanaugh hearings. I know how the Republicans used their time there. Do you think that it's likely that they're going to either attack Democratic motives during their time questioning him, or is it going to be showboating for the president? I mean, what do you expect their strategy to be?
That's a good point, John. I think it's going to be a little bit of both. Last night on Hannity, and this is a show that Trump religiously watches, he talked about how tonight he's going to spend some time instructing right-wing members of Congress on how to question Mueller. And what I think is really important that people understand, when they see this line of questioning, it's likely going to be distant and far removed from what you and I and just the casual observer understands this case to be in relation to. So the right-wing interpretation and understanding of this story is just a completely different planet. There are a totally different cast of characters. And as someone who unfortunately has to watch Fox News primetime every night, it's a stark wake-up call to what they're living in. There's people like Bruce and Nellie Orr, Stefan Halper, people that you and I don't really know outside of if we just watch Fox. But that's who they think is really at the bottom of this. You're going to see a lot of this deep state narrative. You're going to see a lot of showboating, like you said, from right-wing people trying to impress the president and really trying to make Mueller into this partisan hack job figure that Trump really wants him to be seen as.
So we have Donald Trump on screen right now. Now, he goes back and forth saying he's not going to watch it, or he's going to watch a little bit. I mean, he says that all the time on things that he definitely ends up watching. Guy's got to fill his screen time. Do you think that it's possible that he might attempt to distract from the Mueller testimony in some fashion?
You know, that's an interesting point. He might. This is someone who likes to manipulate the media. This is somebody who likes to divert attention with tweets and whatnot. I'd be interested to see if this is something he deploys. One thing I do think people should be mindful of. So you have this all day coverage from every network, right? Now Fox has dedicated a day of coverage to this as well, and they're pushing forward Brett Baer and Martha McCallum. So on our site at Media Matters, we have listed every single instance that Brett Baer and Martha McCallum have used their shows and their platforms to run interference in this investigation for the Trump administration, mislead viewers, and otherwise work hand in hand with the Trump administration. And it's pretty eye-opening when you see some of the things that they've said and done on their shows and how we've understood this case to be. It's just, again, like as we talked about in the last segment, the way the close, cozy relationship between Fox and the Trump administration should send shivers down our spines.
I hear what you're saying, but that's Fox's news side. I mean, they're just straight down the line, object. Anyway, okay. So, if I were to guess, if I were to look into the heads of Democrats in the Senate and in the House, ones who want something to come of this, I think that their number one wish would be he reveals something big, something we didn't see in the report, which he says he's only going to talk about what was in the report. Or he's going to actually say what's sort of obvious in the report, which is, yes, he committed obstruction of justice. I couldn't do anything about it, but it's on you. But I think that one tier below that, if that doesn't happen, and it's unlikely, I think, to happen, would be just talking about this again might get through, that people weren't going to read a massive report, and the media narrative around the report's release was purposefully derailed by William Barr and all that group. That just talking about it might break through. Do you think that there might be something to that?
So there is a chance that could happen, but I guess I'm more cynical on this. In a personal capacity, I'm very cynical on this, and this is, I'm coming as somebody who organized a protest that ended up spreading nationwide in 2017, calling for an independent inquiry into these allegations. I at the end of the day, Robert Mueller is a Republican. He's worked in Republican administrations. He's a party loyalist. So I don't know. Maybe I'm too cynical. We'll see. But I just don't think that we're going to have this explosive moment. I don't think we're going to have this breakthrough, because at the end of the day, everyone's already made up their minds. I don't. I don't know what he could say or do that would change people on the right's opinion and break from Trump.
You might end up being right. So it seems pretty clear that from our points of view, expectations are low. But we will, of course, be tuning in and seeing if anything big comes out. As always, Jordan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. We come back, Medicaid expansion. It happened in some states, but not in others. We're going to take a look at the cost of that after this. It's not often that you can measure the cost in actual lives of Republican opposition to Barack Obama's policies, but today we've got one, and the cost is high. It has to do with the ACA and Medicaid expansion. So let's talk about how this was supposed to work when the law was passed. The Affordable Care Act originally imposed a Medicaid expansion nationwide with a provision that the federal government would pick up 100% of the expansion cost in its first 3 years, declining in stages to a permanent 90% share where it stands now. So that was supposed to be how it worked, that the federal government would give large quantities of money to the states so that they could expand access to Medicaid, which obviously if you qualify for, you need because you're automatically in a group that is less able to pay for your own health insurance. So that was gonna be a great part of the law. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court, in its look at the ACA as a whole, which allowed it to continue, also added a provision by Chief Justice John Roberts that individual governors would be allowed to reject expansion of Medicaid. And in the end, many did, many Republican governors. Now, because they didn't take that free money, which just let's stop for 1 second to acknowledge how unprecedented that is, that you control the state, the federal government is willing to give you millions or billions of dollars to benefit your people, and you say, no, I don't want it. And you make up some sort of BS about how 3 years from now, I don't want to cover 10% of the cost. That is inane. That has never happened before that they turned down money in that way, but they did here. Now let's take a look at how that cost the people of these states. Well, a new paper says that somewhere around 15,000, they actually say 15,600 Americans died between the years 2014 and 2017 as a result of states that turned down the free money available to them from the federal government through the provisions of the ACA. So look, there's a lot of ways that that manifests in this all-encompassing study. To just give you an idea of one way, one study cited by the team found a significant 8.5% reduction in mortality among patients with end-stage renal disease after they enrolled in Medicaid. Now, if you're in a place where they didn't expand it and you can't get on Medicaid and you can't be a part of that group, then you have a measurable nearly 10% higher chance of dying as a result of just that one illness. Now, when you expand that over a wide range of illnesses, what you get across the country for 3 years are more than 15,000 Americans. I will leave it to you to input how many natural disasters that number accounts for, how many 9/11s that number accounts for. That is a gigantic number of Americans who died completely needlessly because a couple of Republican governors thought, screw President Obama, I don't want his money, and I'm not going to hurt if I don't take it. I'll be fine. In fact, I'll look strong in front of Republicans in my state and around the country. I'll look like I'm actually taking part in the generally Senate-led opposition to Barack Obama's agenda. This was one way that they could take part, and it had a high cost indeed. So let's talk about some of what else came out of it. One of their sort of conclusions from the paper was, this highlights an ongoing cost to non-adoption that should be relevant to both state policymakers and their constituents. Here's the thing. The state policymakers that are amenable to this sort of message, that will listen to it and learn from it, they already think that Medicaid expansion was a good thing. And the ones who didn't want it in the first place are not gonna care about these numbers, they're not gonna pay attention, and they're surely not gonna trumpet these numbers to their own people. Our only hope at this point is that enough people in the media talk about this story and that study and the cost that it gets through to some of the people living in these states to make them think, yeah, wasn't it weird that we turned down that free money? Why was my governor not willing to not even go to bat for me or fight for me, but just accept funds? Why did he turn his back on us? Because the thing is, they want to say that they believe ideologically that the sort of people that'd be injured and killed in this sort of way would be Democrats. But a lot of them are, a lot of them in these states, I mean, they have Republican governors. These are fairly red states. And so a lot of Republicans, a lot of people who might be natural Trump fans, they died on this hill that Republicans forced them to fight on. Let's talk a little bit more about how, if we were to reverse this and expand access to health insurance for this group, how it might benefit them. There's robust evidence that Medicaid increases the use of healthcare, including types of care that are well established as efficacious, such as prescription drugs and screening and early detection of cancers that are responsive to treatment. So it's not just that when an emergency happens, people have access to health insurance that can deal with it thanks to expansion. It's also that, and this is the case across every conversation we ever have about health insurance, people will be more attentive to their needs and make it so that it doesn't become an emergency that requires drastic action that's also far more expensive. That is one of the benefits of making sure that your entire population is covered in some fashion. And we could have had that if Republican governors would have not stood in the way. Now, the sad thing is that while this study goes from 2014 to 2017, you can expect that someday they're gonna have to update this with updated numbers of Americans who have died because of this. Now, I want you to take a look at a map. It's a map of America, and it shows the states that adopted Medicaid expansion and those who didn't. I don't think I need to break down for you the sort of pattern that we're seeing here. It is almost overwhelmingly red states. In some cases, I would say more purple, like Wisconsin. That might be a better example of a purple state there. And they just chose not to do it. And their people are suffering. And unfortunately, their governors don't care. I really hope. I hope that, you know, it's not just, let's see, I saw this talked about in the LA Times, and we're covering it here on TDR. I hope that, like, can we get Matt to talk about it, or Chris Hayes or Shep Smith or something, some national figure that will actually be listened to by politicians? That would be awesome. Because while this is a disaster and there's no recovering those lives, the people who needlessly died, we could avoid further deaths in the future if we choose to do that. We'll have to see if our policymakers who still have control of this sort of thing are responsible enough to do that in the future. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, one more block for you. We're gonna break down some international news in Meanwhile In. Okay, we've covered pretty much all the important news here in the US, so why don't we turn now to news from around the world in our segment, Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in Australia, and in fact, a couple of other countries too, it's pretty much an around the world thing outside of the US. Instagram is doing some experimentation and it might actually be for the good. So Instagram is hiding the number of likes on posts in several countries, including Australia and Japan, in order to remove pressure on users. A source from inside of the company says the goal is that users feel less judged and to see whether this change can help people focus less on likes and more on telling their story. So look, I think that this is a good thing, as I'm gonna describe. Understand in the background, studies have linked social media platforms to affecting mental health, especially of young people. Now, admittedly, that sentence doesn't say whether the effect is positive or negative, but we know. So you've been on social media, right? It is hell. It's basically Mad Max. And I get hate when I say this sort of thing, but why were the numbers ever visible? Really? Likes, retweets, favorites, any of that. Why does anyone else need to know what those numbers are? I sort of get an argument for why, like if I post a picture, I should see how many people have liked it, I guess. That still seems like it's gonna manipulate me into constantly feeling like I need to have that number go up or else I'm not loved enough by the outside world. But if I put up the picture, why would the control room need to know how many likes are on it? How is that anything other than manipulation playing on fairly basic negative psychology? I don't know at this point. I do know that it's in their best interest to have those numbers be visible, these companies, because it gets people to be competitive. It allows corporations to sort of identify who they should be paying to use that sort of platform. That's beneficial for them. And I get why it would get people to be more invested in the platforms, because if they feel like they're engaged, not in just sharing an aspect of their life or their thoughts or anything like that, but engaged in a competition where there's literal winners or losers, that will increase engagement with the platform, I guess. But nowhere in any of this is the actual betterment of society or an individual state of mind anywhere to be seen. And so I get that it's controversial. And I think that the people that have a knee-jerk reaction to this sort of change, it's sort of like the American dream. It's like we get that it's really not gonna happen for us, but we've been raised to believe that, oh no, I'm the one who's gonna become a millionaire, right? Yeah, if I just post enough pictures of my dog or board games, someday I'll get 10,000 likes on a picture, right? But it's not actually gonna happen. And think about the toll along the way. Okay, I could literally talk about this for the rest of the show, but we do have other news, so I'm gonna move on. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in much darker news, in Poland, politicians are stoking both hatred and fear of the LGBTQ community to help them in their political aims. This is a story that's very familiar to us here in the US and around the globe. Now, I'm not gonna go super in depth into the internal politics of Poland. It is not my expertise by any means, but let's talk a little bit about what's been going on there recently. Ahead of parliamentary elections this fall, a party called Law and Justice has thrown the full weight of its party apparatus behind a campaign that is marginalizing Poland's LGBT community, its critics say. To give you an idea of some of the ways that this manifests, let's bring up this social media post from a Polish politician. Most of you probably read Polish, so you can just read that. I'm joking, it's been translated. We say no to the attack on children. We will not be intimidated. We will defend Polish families. Oh, I see. So it's not that you hate these people, it's that you just wanna protect the children. What about the children? That is always the mantra for people who wanna demonize an outgroup and seem like they're in fact the moral superior ones. It's not that I'm scared of these people. It's not that I hate these people. It's not that I think that I can get you to vote for me if you also hate these people. It's that I care about the children. It actually does go a little bit farther than this. They have these self-described LGBT free zones that have been declared. You get bumper stickers and you can put it up in your store window or something saying, this is not a place where these people will be tolerated. Now, Paweł Grzybowski, an advisor of the prime minister, notes that LGBT free declarations have no actual meaning in terms of regulations. There's no suggestion that being gay will be outlawed in Poland, and same-sex unions and adoptions by same-sex couples are not legal anyway. But the message that it sends is pretty much straightforward, said a director of the Warsaw-based campaign against homophobia. There is no place for LGBT people in our community. And that is the thing. It has no legal meaning. And yet it really does have a meaning. For the people who like that party, who are already suspicious of this group, kind of disdainful towards them, it lets them feel more comfortable to be free about their hatred. And while it has no legal ramifications in terms of a regulation, it does allow that community, people who are LGBTQ, to feel like an outsider in their own homes. And so again, while there's particular flavor to this that is Polish, this is a story we've seen throughout human history in literally every country. We're still seeing it in a lot of America with some of the moves by the Trump administration. And it's sad to see it being used so openly, so transparently by politicians across the face of the earth. Okay, meanwhile in. Meanwhile in Iceland, a memorial has been set up for a death. Now that's not news necessarily, but it's not a person that died, it's a glacier. The first of Iceland's 400 glaciers to be lost to the climate crisis will be remembered with a memorial plaque and a somber warning for the future to be unveiled by scientists and local people next month. So we have a picture of the plaque that we can put up and we have a translation of what it says there. It says, okay, is the first Iceland glacier to lose its status as a glacier. In the next 200 years, all of our glaciers are expected to follow the same path. This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it. And that right there, maybe I'm just, a bleeding heart environmentalist or whatever, but I get choked up thinking about that. The acknowledgement that no, this is not a person that's dying, but it is us killing something. It is us standing by as something, many things really, but in this case, a glacier die. And we know everything we need to know about what is going on and what the solution is. Those are the famous words of Greta Thunberg, an amazing activist who's been raising awareness around the globe around climate breakdown. We already have all the answers. We could do more studies, sure, but we don't need more studies. We can develop new technologies, sure, but we don't need new technologies. All we need is the political and social will to do what's necessary to not have a long string of these memorials be set up for the next 200 or 300 or 400 years. We already know it all. And one of the things that we sort of suspect, although we don't know yet, is that we might not have the will, that we will continue to vote for politicians who won't take this seriously, who will just watch as it happens, and someday our kids, our grandkids, our great grandkids are gonna look back on us and say, how could you have been so blind? How could you have been so stupid? How could you have cared so little about the world that I will one day inhabit? And we see it happening right now. And so to those of us who do care about this issue, who do want to see something done about it, we need to redouble our efforts. We need to triple our efforts. We need to do everything we can to make sure that not only do we elect the right politicians, but that we put pressure on them so that this is not a thing on their agenda. This is the agenda, and they will prioritize it while there's still time to do something about it. Okay, I just want to briefly say that some of you have been leaving some great comments on iTunes, reviews of the show. I saw that Cedarista said John and Brooke are the best. Side note, there was a Fox News commercial during the break today and it was weird. Let's see, Visa7011 said, great show, speaking the truth. John, please be aware that there's been a lot of ads pushing to watch Fox News. So we do understand that. Unfortunately, there's nothing we can do about it, but we do appreciate your reviews. Please continue leaving those and we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.